Good morning, world travelers and diners. You're listening to On the Menu, which I hope is a regular habit. Ann and Peter Haig. We talk about food, wine, travel, you name it, lifestyle. And we have on the program already our very first guest.
Well, you forgot. You forgot to introduce Peter.
Oh, hello, Peter.
Peter's here, too.
Peter's
been pulling the train for quite a while and had some health problems, so I've been running the program single-handed, Jeff.
Health problems sounds kind of more serious than it was.
She's just rejoining for just the second show that she's been a part of. So we're all very excited to have her back. But we are also excited to have Jeff Shepherd on the phone from Lilybell Farms in somewhere in Oregon.
Well, you took that away from me.
So tell us where somewhere in Oregon is, Jeff.
Somewhere in Oregon is in Central Point, Oregon. It's a small town in southern Oregon, nestled in the foothills of the Siskiyou Mountains. And, we run Lilybell Farms here. We're a small artisan chocolate company.
How did you get there, Jeff?
How did I get here?
First of all, you are a chef, and you did the whole restaurant gig for a number of years.
I did. I followed what I call the Western chef circuit. I started in Los Angeles and worked through Napa Valley, worked up to Seattle, did it for about 20 years, wound up in Hawaii as one of my last paying gigs out there, and spent about 10 years in Hawaii working as a chef and then as a bed and breakfast owner and even running a radio station for a while.
Now, there's a sort of a non sequitur in there somewhere that says, you know, Hawaii is fairly extreme, but Central Point, Oregon is not exactly the next place you would think of going.
That's true. When I was in Hawaii working as a chef, I met a lovely hostess in one of our restaurants, and we fell in love and got married. And after we were there on the island for about 9 years together, we left the island, and we went to where she was from, which was Southern Oregon.
That's how you got there.
Yes, my wife's family is here. And so we sold our business, and she went back to college. And in all of that, I bought a rundown, old, used berry farm. 2 acres of dilapidated berries that over the last 7 years I have replanted completely with 6 varieties of berries and gotten certified organic.
So you're certified organic for your berries.
The berries in this case, Jeff, are what kind of berries?
Oh, strawberries, red raspberries, gold raspberries.
Okay. All right.
Marion berries, that's good.
But the reason that you joined our program was because of some special treats that we read about. And then we asked if you couldn't send them to us. So there's a chocolate side of the business, too.
Yes, there is. I took the berries 5 years ago and thought, well, what am I going to do with these? And I started making raspberry truffles and selling them out of the trunk of my car at farmers markets.
Yeah.
And now I sell to well over 300 stores nationwide and have won lots of international awards for my chocolates.
Right. Now, I might sort of forewarn people, these are not your grandmother's chocolates.
No, they're not.
I have to tell you, I mean, we had our kids here, and I took a bite of the spicy caramel and thought that my mouth was on fire.
Well, talk
to us about what you make.
They are cayenne caramels. That's one of our new flavors. We have 2 new flavors that have garnered some attention recently. One is the cayenne caramel that you tried, a soft, very soft, semi-liquid center caramel in dark chocolate with a distinct cayenne pepper heat and flavor. That particular caramel just won the 2008 SCOBY Awards down in New Mexico.
I bet it would.
Yes, we won the Fiery Food Competition.
Yeah. We've had Dave DeWitt on the show.
Oh, good. Yeah. Dave runs that show. That's great.
Yeah, he does. And also, we have his book.
Uh-huh.
He does some really interesting stuff. He also wrote a book on Da Vinci's Kitchen.
Yes, he did.
Yeah, I read that, too.
He's a nice guy.
He's really a historian. I mean, I don't know how I do know how he got into the chili head stuff, but he's a historian and he likes research.
Good. Yeah, well, we enjoy working with him. We also did the one I sent you, which was the smoky blue truffle.
Now, please explain the smoky blue truffle to our listeners.
It is, without question, the perfect marriage of smoked blue cheese, milk chocolate, and roasted almond.
Because it doesn't hurt that you have absolutely world-famous, world-award-winning cheese just relatively nearby, too.
Right, about 100 feet across the parking lot.
Is Sarah, are you right next door?
Yeah, we're right next door.
Oh, that's amazing.
We are right next door to the Rogue Creamery, who's won all kinds of international and national awards for their blue cheeses.
Oh, they have fabulous, fabulous cheeses.
Yes, and they asked me. I mean, the cheesemakers and, you know, David Grimmels from the Creamery, they all asked me, can you do anything with our cheeses in chocolate? And I said, I don't know. Let me try.
David's been on the show, too, by the way.
Yes, he has.
Yeah.
So I experimented with all of their cheeses and a lot of different chocolate combinations, and one day we came up with this batch that was just perfect. It tasted fantastic. No one flavor dominated the other. It was a really nice blend, and it was interesting without being offensive, and people loved it.
Yeah, now, everybody here raved about it, and the kids said they couldn't taste the cheese. Now, I did taste the cheese.
The cheese is blended all the way through it, so there's no chunk of cheese anywhere, so not one piece is going to be stronger than another. But it is a subtle marriage of blue cheese and chocolate, so it has kind of a chocolate cheesecake tang to it. And the smokiness of the cheese actually blends with the almonds on the outside, which are roasted. So it tastes like a chocolate cheesecake with a smoked almond crust.
Hmm. And they come in packages of five.
They come in packages of five, and we just introduced a 12-piece for our website for the holidays.
You know, why five? I thought that was an unusual number.
Yes, yes. Well, five makes two people want more. Yeah. No, just kidding.
I knew there was some reason. There's some kind of an intellectual undercurrent to this whole thing.
Here's what happened in our house, Jeff. There were packages of five. Our son and daughter-in-law were here. They surreptitiously ate four out of each pack of five.
Yes, I see that happening a lot. Anyway.
They couldn't bear to take the last one, but the last one was all they left.
Now your wife took a bite and left the rest of it for you. Well, that was generous.
So I only got one and a half altogether.
Oh, brutal, brutal.
Doesn't seem entirely fair, does it?
Tell our listeners why this sweet name for this company when you have such wicked chocolates.
Well, it is named after my daughter, Lily, and my wife, Belle. And so I just thought I would name it after them. If I'm going to work 80 hours a week, at least I can do is stare at their name all day on packaging.
Yeah.
Is that the name of the farm also?
Yes, it is.
Okay, so that was...
Yes, it is.
How do people get these chocolates? You said you have a...
They go to our website. LilyBellFarms.com, LilyBellFarms.com.
Okay. And you do internet orders?
Yes, we do. We take orders on the internet. We also have a toll-free number out there. They can call us, and we'll gladly take their order over the phone.
And you said you're just opening a new store?
Yes, we are. We are opening our first retail outlet next weekend, as a matter of fact. And that'll be located at 211 North Front Street in Central Point, Oregon.
Well, everybody's going to go by there, aren't they?
They are, because we're right next door to the Creamery.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, now you can get your cheese and chocolate fix in the same location without having to, you know, go very far.
And I guess the cheese guys probably are, at this point, perhaps they're the draw. People haven't quite cottoned in on Lily Bell yet.
No, they don't. Well, they know who we are, but we've never had a front. We're kind of hidden in a warehouse in the middle of nowhere. And so, you know, for the last year, people have been hunting us down on their GPS units and coming into our factory, even though we don't have a store. So we thought it's time to take our presence out to Main Street.
There you go. Now,
I really would like to take a trip off the usual route trip out to the Pacific Northwest. We just, later on in this hour, we're going to be interviewing the author of a book called The Pacific Northwest Wine and Dining.
Perfect.
Have you seen it?
No, I haven't.
It's fabulous. It talks, it doesn't have you in there. You better talk to her about that.
Well, again, I haven't had a location for her yet.
Yeah, it does have Fran's chocolates in because Fran Bigelow is a good friend.
Oh, sure. She's got three nice stores up in Seattle.
Yeah. Now, there are other people. It seems that the people starting out as independent artisanal chocolatiers end up adding retail to their repertoire.
It seems like the way to go. Well, we work really hard and we sell a lot of it, but we sell a lot of it wholesale to stores. And eventually we look at that and go, wow, these stores are getting a lot of money for our chocolates. Maybe we should do that.
Oh, so that's the motivation. I see. Now,
we want to get an equal share.
Money. It's always about money.
So you can also buy at what kinds of retail stores?
Let's see. We sell to a lot of specialty food shops around the country. It depends on your region and where you're located. But you guys are in Philadelphia?
We're actually in Pittsburgh.
Here in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, but it goes off the internet, so it's everybody.
Okay. Yeah, we don't actually sell in Pittsburgh or Philadelphia, for that matter. We sell in Scranton,
Pennsylvania.
Oh, that's good. There you go. Yeah. Is there a stall locator on your website, Jack?
There is, and it's getting updated constantly because it's changing rapidly. The Smoky Blues seem to have been picked up by cheese shops all over the place that don't normally sell chocolate.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, well, we have
there's a great store called Mon Ami Chocolates here that handles everybody.
Oh, good.
You should be in touch with them.
I'll have to.
Tell me what the next flavor is, Jeff.
What's the next flavor?
Yeah, what's coming out next?
Oh, my. Well, I'm opening all these stores, so I've created about 12 new flavors in the last 3 weeks.
Tell us.
Just for the store. But I'm really, you know what? I'm perfecting my buttercreams right now.
Oh, okay.
Using my fruit. We just created a Marionberry buttercream that is just out of this world.
That sounds fabulous.
Yeah, it's in a nice chocolate cup and strawberry passion fruit buttercreams and pistachio buttercreams.
That sounds my kind of thing, pistachio buttercream. Oh, wow.
Yeah, because no good chocolate shop is right without buttercream selection.
Well, you just seem to be having an absolutely wonderful time out there. There is a chef that Anne knows very well from Women Chefs from Restaurant Us called Stephanie Kimmel, I think.
Yeah.
Who's in, I think she's in Salem, Oregon.
Oh.
Which I'm guessing is still some distance away from you.
Oh, it's about 3 hours from me, yeah.
Yeah, so we might find you from Northern California heading north or from Oregon heading south. I'm not sure which.
Either way, we're off the I-5 corridor. It's hard to get to California from Oregon without going past us.
Where's Theo?
Theo Chocolates is in Seattle.
Theo's in Seattle.
Yeah, you know them, those guys too?
Oh, of course.
They're absolutely terrific.
Yeah, I know Joe Finney.
Yeah, Joe Finney. Yeah, because we wanted to do a tour of his show.
Well, what fun it has been talking to you. I know, Jeff.
I hate to say goodbye, Jeff.
Yeah, but you have a store to open?
I have a store to open and a crew to run. Yes, it's time to make chocolate today.
Well, what a delight it was to have you on the program. Thank you so much for joining us.
No,
we can meet you.
You
sometime.
You have a nice day. You come to Oregon, you give us a call.
Thanks, Jeff.
Sure.
Bye.
And now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, listeners. In case you just tuned in, you're with onthemenuradio.com, and we're glad that you're here with us. And remember that you can get in touch with us anytime by sending us email to onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com. And we've got another exciting guest from a truly beautiful part of the country, especially when it comes to food and wine, perhaps not the weather. That's the Pacific Northwest, and Braden Rex Johnson, who just produced a really wonderful book called Pacific Northwest Wining and Dining. How come, Braden?
Well, thank you, Peter, and mainly because our wine regions have gotten so much stronger, especially within the last 10 years. Pacific Northwest Wining and Dining literally could have been written 10 years ago because we didn't have the massive wineries and we didn't have the quality wines, nor did we have any place where you could go to spend the night or have a good meal if you did get to the wine regions.
No, I remember we were there about probably 10 years ago, and the wines were already excellent.
Mm-hmm.
But we did notice, and this is close to Portland, Oregon, that there were very few restaurants and very few places to stay. So it's wonderful to know that that situation's been corrected. I guess the market does wonderful things like that. But we did find the wineries not as crowded. It reminded us of Napa in the 1950s and 1960s. I hope it's still like that.
It's still like that. As you say, Oregon tends to be a little more rustic, a little more family-owned, and a little more sort of march to their own drummer, as it were. Washington, of course, is a little bit more corporate in some ways, although we still have wonderful family-owned wineries that are really, really fun to visit. And Idaho's doing its own thing, 24 wineries, and Okanagan is just a stunning wine region with some amazing, beautifully built wineries, $30 million facilities. So what a delight.
Now, the last name, you ran one by me there.
The Okanagan?
Yes.
That would be in British Columbia.
Oh, that's Western British Columbia.
Yes, the major wine growing region there. And so they have about 94 wineries. It's a really fabulous place to visit.
No, I have read about that. And we will, as we were talking off the air beforehand, we're long overdue to come back out to that part of the country and explore and find out what's changed since we were last there.
Now, who is starting up all these enterprises? Are they coming from other parts of the country? When we were there last, they were all worried about everybody coming from California. They didn't like that.
Well, I don't think that's happening quite so much. I think that a lot of the Microsoft people and some of the people with disposable incomes have certainly started some of the wineries. A lot of winemakers, as you know, it's their passion, and oftentimes it's their second career. Mm-hmm. And so these are people who give up everything, mortgage their homes, you know, put up their credit cards to the hilt to do this. And so that's sort of the sum of people who are doing this. And then, of course, we do have some big corporate enterprises who are snapping up the small, you know, well-known wineries, some of the big brands and all that sort of thing. So it's kind of a mixture, I would say.
But this is not just a book about wine. This is a book about dining, too. I mean, how did you go about creating such a comprehensive survey?
Well, thank you. Well, it was a lot of it, research, of course. It's my 3-year baby. It was about a year in research and then a year of writing and then a year in production. And I just mainly asked people like winemakers and chefs, you know, who are the good chefs? Who are the good winemakers who cook? And I asked a lot of PR people and just, you know, word of mouth, really. I said, who do you cook with? And I found out who some of the good chef winemakers were. And then, of course, the artisan cheesemakers and the chocolatiers. And the
oh, yeah, you have our friend Fran Bigelow in there.
Oh, yeah, she's a doll. She and I are both doms, so Seattle doms, and she was wonderful to let me, you know, have one of her recipes, which is a great gift.
Oh, that's wonderful, yeah.
Yeah.
No, I love her stuff.
I do too.
I love her too. She's a real dom, as you said.
Now, there's another piece of the Northwest that you didn't miss out. We just didn't get around to it yet. And that's some of the wonderful foods that are either grown or grow wild there.
Sure. And that is the whole crux of the book, really, which is Northwest cuisine. And it all starts with such wonderful farmer, forager, and fishers who give us this wonderful provender. And then the chefs take it and they add the Northwest influences. And that would be Native American. So the planking, and that's an amazing way to cook foods, planking and steaming and grilling.
Yeah, you really emphasize that. And I don't know that I actually, up till now, picked it out as so dominant in the area.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just think that there's several restaurants who really make a point of doing the planking, and even those that don't often use that as a technique for cooking because it has such a lovely smokiness. It's a gentle smoke. It's not a hard smoke, and so it goes so well with many different wines, and it just goes well in a lot of different dishes. And then, of course, you have European influences. You have the Scandinavian, of course, is big out here, and Italian, and Mediterranean with the Sephardic Jews who opened up stands in the Pike Place Market early on.
Yeah, that one surprised me, too. I didn't know that history.
Yeah. And then, of course, Asian. I think so many people think of Pan-Asian when they think of the Pacific Northwest. And, of course, it's our proximity to, you know, the Asian countries. But it just has added so many interesting top notes to our cuisine. And, you know, finally, the Latino, which is kind of a more recent thing, but mainly because a lot of our migrant workers have become farmers and started their own farms, and they bring their goods to the farmers market. So we call it sort of the ultimate fusion cuisine.
Yeah. What a concept.
And talk to us a little bit about the structure of the book.
Oh, well, that's so interesting, Peter, because when I actually devised the book in the first place, I did it by wine varietals, and I thought we'd just go through and, you know, Chardonnay and Pinot Noir and all the sort of Northwest wine varietals. And as I got into writing it, I decided that it would be much more interesting to have it laid out more like a travelogue. And so I think if people come to the Northwest, they might logically start in one of the big cities, such as Portland, Seattle, or Vancouver. And then if they have time, they might sort of spin out and rent a car and go to some of the wine regions. So in Seattle, that might be the Woodinville wine country, or in Portland, of course, it would be the Willamette Valley. And then as they have more time, if they have more time, or if they make another visit, they might head more to the Yakima Valley and Walla Walla in Washington, or down to Southern Oregon if they are in Oregon, or if they have time, if they're in Vancouver, they might actually get out to the Okanagan, which is about a 3 hours drive from Vancouver. So it's a bit more of a trek, as it were.
Okay, so you've got the basic introduction to everything. And then you do it geographically, which is exactly the way I would go about doing a book, but that's only because I have a master's degree in geography, so I have a geographer's, have a geographer's view of almost everything that should be done. But so you weave the recipes regionally by who produces them rather than because they necessarily belong in that particular region.
Well, no. You'll notice that, like in Seattle, in the Seattle section, all those recipes are from Seattle restaurants or chefs or whomever, or Fran Bigelow, you know, the chocolatier, that sort of thing. So if you go there, you can actually go to that restaurant. And there's also the handy information about the address and the website. Of course, we always have to have that nowadays, and the telephone number. And so people can really use it. And that's, you know, it was interesting because people keep talking to me about this book as a travelogue. And I mean, I'm such a cookbook author. I always think of it more as cookbook, but it kind of is wine primer, food wine pairing guide, travelogue, and cookbook, which I think is what's making it be, you know, really popular and useful to people.
And it's working out very successfully.
It's going really well. Thank you for asking. Amazon, it keeps kind of bouncing back on the Northwest list between number one and like number two or three. So that's been exciting. And we got a very strong review in Pacific Northwest Magazine, which is our Sunday supplement in the Seattle Times, in which a dear friend of mine and very generous writer in his own right, Greg Atkinson.
We've interviewed Greg.
Yeah, he's darling. And
he was someplace else, though, when we interviewed him.
Well, he compared me to Patricia Wells, who's one of my complete heroes in life.
Yeah, we've had her on the show, too.
I'm sure, yeah. And it's all this very incestuous food and wine thing, isn't it?
It's funny, isn't it? Everybody knows everybody.
Yeah, I know.
What's
great.
Greg doing now?
Greg, of course, writes his column for The Times and has for many years. And he's doing lots of consulting, and he has a wonderful website, which is northwestessentials.com. So he every day, you know, updates it, and he has a blog, and he does a radio show. He's very active, very active.
Now, do you have a website?
I do, and mine is called northwestwininganddining.com, and it's all spelled out. And I don't do a blog because I'm just not disciplined enough, but I do a monthly updated Northwest Notes section, and it tells where I've been and, you know, talks about my book tours and all that kind of stuff. So that's been really fun for me. I love that because it's so current, you know.
Oh, yeah.
This book, by the time it came out, some of the chefs had left and some of the wine.
I know. Oh, it's terrible, isn't it?
Oh, it's heartbreaking. Aaron Cronfeld left the herb farm after 17 years.
I know. I have found no reference to that. Everybody's sort of backlogged with still having.
He left?
Oh, yeah. It was months ago.
I didn't know that.
But it's not caught up with him yet in any of the things people are writing.
Oh, well, that's amazing. I thought he owned it.
No, he's just been, he was the, you know, I think he was a starting chef 17 years ago. If not, he was, you know, one of the very first. But, you know, Corey Schreiber also left Wildwood, and Greg Feeney left Lumiere, and it's just been this kind of, you know.
Where did Schreiber go?
I'm not sure. He was looking for a job last we talked. He had remarried and was very happy, though, and I'm sure he'll land on his feet. He's such a strong chef and just has such a family tradition, you know, in Oregon and everything. So.
Yeah, we loved Greg Higgins from Higgins Restaurant in Portland. That's one of our favorites.
Yes, I love him.
And the Heathman Bar and Pizzeria. Mm-hmm. Is that one still there?
Oh, yes, and there's a wonderful shot of Philippe Boulot, the chef, you know, talking to his crew before the daily dinner service, so you'll get a kick out of that. I love that dining room. It's so bright and yellow, and it's just so urban. I love it there.
But you're also talking to someone who's been to Walla Walla, Washington.
You know, you may have been.
I was only once.
But you and I don't say it right because they say it Walla Walla.
Walla Walla. Yeah.
Walla Walla.
Walla Walla. It's just like Wagga. It's just like Wagga Wagga in Australia.
Well, but you were there, what, 10 years ago, did you say?
I was there now probably 16 years ago.
Oh, wow. You must go back. It's the little downtown's all been redone. It's just so vintage. It's so sweet. And, oh, my gosh, the wines are just, as you know, stunning wines. You know,
but our favorite winemaker out there, Charles Smith, I understand, left the business.
Oh, well, his photo's in the book. He better not have. He's on his motorcycle. So
no, I heard that he had. He used to be a rock music producer.
I know.
Before he became a winemaker.
He's kind of the bad boy of the wine business. It would surprise me not that much in that his magnificent wines got bought out or he was merging with a big company. So maybe, you know,
not his trip.
Maybe that's probably the answer.
Isn't he wonderful?
he's wild and wonderful. But, you know, if he really did sell his own label, K Vintners, I would be really surprised because he loves to make wine. I mean, he lives to make wine. I can't imagine him not doing that.
Well, check it out.
I like to keep on looking, but I heard that he had stopped doing that and was doing something else, but I could be wrong. There's so much going on out there.
Well, hope not. We like his wines.
our old friend Tom Douglas goes from strength to strength.
He's amazing. I mean, he's up to like number six restaurant with his serious pie, you know, from Greek to Italian.
Yeah, I don't understand how he does it.
I don't know. He's just the golden boy. He's got the Midas touch, and, you know, but he's the biggest promoter still, too. I mean, he's at Costco. He's indefatigable. He promotes the heck out of all of his projects, which is great. So,
yeah, he makes wonderful rubs, spice rubs that we use all the time.
I use it, too. I love his seafood rub, actually.
Yeah, we do, too.
Not on salmon. I don't like a salmon rub as much as I like seafood rub on salmon, which may be kind of contrary, but yeah. I use that, and I use a little bit of the Hawaiian sea salt that's so beautiful, the kind of pink-colored one, and then some sashimi togarashi, and I just put that on my salmon, and it's my, like, we have that at least once a week.
Anne made a creative contribution to our cuisine just last week. We were trying to figure out what spice to put on shrimp.
Oh.
And I said, we have this mushroom rub.
Ooh.
He said, why don't you use that? And it turned out it was absolutely...
It's porcini.
It was absolutely terrific. A porcini sounded like porcini dust.
Ooh,
it was really
was
quite
yummy.
Extraordinary.
Wonderful.
Wild American shrimp.
Well, let's pick your brain for some tips.
Okay.
First of all, favorite wines of the region.
I am a white wine drinker, which is probably not a real popular thing to say, but I think that they pair better with many foods, and I don't eat a lot of red meat, so I love Rieslings, and I am a great fan of Sauvignon Blanc, and if I am going to drink a red, it's usually a Pinot Noir, and I just think that the finesse of Pinot Noirs are just, and pretty our Oregon ones, they just go well with so many foods. So I sort of drink logically sometimes.
Yeah, we enjoyed Pinot Grigio or Pinot Gris from Oregon a lot. We were getting that for quite a while until our wine club had to fire us.
Was that Elk Cove?
Yeah, that was Elk Cove, and we had some Viognier from there that was absolutely fabulous.
Oh, that's so good. Yeah, it's interesting that they're doing some of those more southern type grapes down there now, but often also. Sourcing them from Southern Oregon, like the Del Rio Vineyard. It's really a hot vineyard down in Southern Oregon right now. So that's interesting.
Hmm. Yeah. Now, Theo Chocolates isn't in your book, is it?
I'm sorry?
Theo.
Yeah. Theo Chocolate?
Theo is not. You know, they have come online fairly recently, and I know them certainly. And I just chose to put Fran in. You know, she's just been around so long. And
sure.
Yeah, that was the other thing. I thought I was being so smart getting these venerable places. And again, you know, the Herb Farm and Corey and Lumiere, and then these people leave. So it was tough. It was very tough.
It's a fact of life, unfortunately. That's just exactly what happens.
Mm-hmm.
Listeners, this is quite the best book that I have seen on this part of the country. I have a lot of resource information that I've been collecting because we used to enjoy to go there and we're going to go back. But I don't think I'm going to have to look any further than what's here. All we'll have to do is we'll have to make corrections for Braden, and then she'll have to do Pacific Northwest Wining and Dining Revisited or something like that.
I am so there, Peter. There's so much more to cover.
And there are wonderful photographs by
Jackie Johnson.
So all in all, it's a book to curl up with, especially on cold winter nights, which, of course, is exactly the season we're getting into now.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
We enjoyed having you as part of the show. Any final thoughts for our listeners?
Oh, gosh, just wine, dine, and savor the journey.
Yes.
That's why I write all my books, so I've been writing that quite a lot lately, I'm glad to say.
Yeah, I'll do that.
It's such a great part of the world, and as we said during the interview, On the Menu definitely needs to go back, and you should put it on your travel plans, too. But anyway, right now, it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Remember, you can email us at all times, or at any time, I guess is the best way to put it. The address is onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com. And do check in to see what's up and new about food, wine, travel, and lifestyle on our website. We revel in fabulous guests, and we have probably one of the most fabulous of guests today, James Vilas, who, James, welcome to the show, and I must say, I am a long, long time fan of yours.
Oh, bless your heart. Thank you. Good to be with you.
I'm thrilled. I'm thrilled to have you on the show.
I'm thrilled also.
So, now we're going to do two books. books for you today. You're so prolific. This one is The Glory of Southern Cooking. I can't tell you how many people we've interviewed about Southern cooking, from the Lee brothers to Louis Osteen.
Louis is a very dear old friend of mine.
Yeah, well, and we did the Charleston Food and Wine Festival this year, so we saw a lot of people there.
Boy, he knows how to cook.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's that new restaurant now. We have to go to Las Vegas.
Yeah.
But there's something about, first of all, I mean, I ask everybody who's written about Southern cooking, you know, why is it suddenly so popular? But the second thing is, your book is very different from the others, and I was trying to think of a word for it before we came on air. And, I mean, I wanted to say authentic, but it's not that it's authentic.
Comprehensive.
It's legitimate, is my word.
Well, if you can tell by my mushmouth, you tell by my accent.
Yeah.
It's in my blood. And it's you know, I've lived with Southern food, was born and bred on it, and it's today as much of my heritage and as much of my interest. It's the food that I cook the most. I live on Long Island, but I still, you know, they say you can take a boy out of the South, but you can't take the South out of the boy. And these Yankees here, when I cook, they all want Southern food. I mean, Southern food is the, and there's, I think, a legitimate reason, Ann, and that is because we do have, as far as I'm concerned, the only legitimate cuisine in the United States.
Yeah, you said that.
Yeah, you remember Bob Carter from the Peninsula Grill in Charleston said the same thing. He said, this is authentic American food.
Well, it is. I mean, after all, we've been in business over 300 years at this thing. And we're really the only really codified style of cooking. And above all, Peter, I mean, we are the only ones, for some blessed reason, who have not been infected and homogenized by all of these ridiculous changes taking place in the United States and all this fusion cuisine and so forth. We have held basically to our roots, and so we've allowed Southern cooking, you know, Southern cuisine, to evolve naturally over 300 years, and we're very proud of it.
And there are some wonderful exponents of it, like John Besh at Restaurant August in New Orleans, and Bob Carter and Bob Wagoner in Charleston.
Bob Wagoner is a great chef.
Isn't he fabulous?
Yeah, he's a marvelous chef. He's been there a long time.
Yeah,
he sure has. And Bob Wagoner is going back to those traditional roots as well as all the French stuff that he was
Same with Louis Osteen. And to a certain extent, let's admit it, so does Emeril Lagasse. I mean, Emeril has done Southern cooking very proud.
Yeah. He's not from the South either, though.
No, he's originally from New England, but he's, as you can tell by his accent, he has a New Orleans accent. But he does understand Southern food.
Now, you have a very extensive collection here of bread and bread-related recipes.
Well, that's important.
Yeah, what's Filpi bread?
Filpi bread, now that Americans will not know. Filpi bread is a highly distinctive bread of the Carolina Lowcountry. And that bread goes back probably 400 years. We think probably to the Indians. Filpi bread is found primarily, let's say, between Charleston, really near Georgetown, between Charleston and Myrtle Beach. And you go down there along Highway 17, and you'll find Filpi bread everywhere, and it's a wonderful bread.
It starts out with an ingredient list, bacon grease.
Sure.
Well, of course, yeah. Bacon is the world's wonderful thing.
Not just Filpi bread, as far as bacon grease is concerned. We love to put bacon grease in our cornbread.
I thought you said...
That would be good.
I thought you said filthy bread.
Yeah.
No, filthy bread.
Filthy, yeah.
Now, we did have Crescent Dragon Wagon, who just wrote the Cornbread Gospels, on the program. If you haven't seen that book, you should find... If you like cornbread, it's a history book about cornbread just as much as it's a... Just as much as it's a cookbook about cornbread. And I didn't realize cornbread was such a cult, but I'm sure you know it is.
Yeah, it is. That's not the book that was edited by John Edge, is it?
No,
I think she did it herself. It's called The Cornbread Gospels.
No, I don't know that.
Well, you should definitely look it up if you like cornbread.
Cornbread is my second cousin, you know. I mean, couldn't live without cornbread and biscuits.
Yeah. Now, you have an unusual one, scalloped potatoes and fennel.
Why not, Anne? That's a creation.
Yeah,
and
I was going to say that doesn't sound very Southern to me.
Yes, well, it is now. I'd say in the last 20 to 30 years, fennel is, I noticed I was home in September, and anise is fennel in all the markets now, and Southerners do love fennel because we love licorice. Southerners will always love anything with licorice flavor.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yes. And so I figured, you know, why we normally would use, you know, in our regular scallop potatoes, which is a gratin, we would normally use just onions. Why not go ahead and add a new distinctive flavor of that family and do it with fennel, and it is perfectly delicious using bulb fennel.
Yeah, now, you augmented, shall we say, some of these recipes?
Sure. Okay. You always, there's no such thing as a recipe for me. Every time I do a book or every time I cook, as a matter of fact, I'm changing something.
So you must cook a lot, Jim, huh?
I cook all the time.
But so what you're saying is I write my cookbook and here's the recipe, but what you expect is when someone will pick it up, they'll add and subtract ingredients if you like it?
Peter, I encourage readers to do that.
Okay.
Now, there's certain limits, of course. I mean, I do not encourage readers, for example, to add more bacon powder to bacon powder biscuits unless they want to suffer the consequences.
Yeah.
And I do not, you know, I wouldn't encourage readers. This is the lessons I learned from my mother. I would not encourage readers ever to do something like short ribs of beef with wine instead of water, mm-hmm. or maybe beer at the very most.
Yeah, I have Charlie Palmer's recipe for short ribs, which calls for two large cans of Guinness. I don't use quite that much.
Yeah, that's fine. But the minute you go as far as say using red wine, a Merlot or something in that, you are totally transforming that dish and you're losing the Southern identity.
No kidding. So they can't be Southern short ribs. They could be short ribs from somewhere else, but they're certainly not Southern.
Sure, exactly. I mean, then they become almost a French dish. They almost become like a bœuf bourguignon.
Mm-hmm. Well, now let's switch horses.
Could I say one thing, by the way,
yes.
Because I saw here's a recipe for burgoo in here, Kentucky burgoo.
Kentucky burgoo.
Yeah, because we have friends who are both from Kentucky, but one's from one side of the mountain, the other one's from the other side, and their recipes are wildly divergent.
And it can change in Kentucky down the block. Literally, and I mean wars, as many wars in Kentucky are fought over the proper way to make a burgoo as wars are fought in Virginia and Georgia over how to make a Brunswick stew or how to do real barbecue in my state, North Carolina.
Sure,
wars, and nothing is more variable. I don't guess any dish in the South is more variable than burgoo.
Burgoo.
You can dump anything in that stuff.
Well, now let's switch to it. Let's switch horses to it. Different kind of cookbook altogether. It's hard to describe it as a single ingredient cookbook, but that's certainly implied by what's on the label. It's called the Bacon Cookbook, James's probably most recent cookbook, and there's a sort of a dedication in there, I think.
You were dedicated.
You dedicate this book to what you describe as perhaps the world's most perfect ingredient.
It's the most perfect food. It's the most beloved food. It's God's gift, I think, to gastronomy. As I say in that, who does not love, who would dare say they don't love bacon?
Yeah, but the one thing you very cleverly say as you analyze the comparison between bacon and other foods is that it's the wrong thing to do to sit down and eat a quarter of a pound of bacon at one sitting.
I'm adamant about that. But Peter, that's not just the problem with bacon. That's the problem in America with all foods.
Yes, yes.
And people complaining about, oh, bacon's got so much fat. Well, I did a lot of research, and I prove in the book, and I write all about it, about how two slices of bacon are thousands of times healthier than one glazed donut, one hot dog, or one hamburger in terms of sodium, in terms of cholesterol, in terms of fat. And anyone who sits down and eats 8 and 10 slices of bacon really doesn't deserve to be at a civilized table, as far as I'm concerned.
Right, I agree. I agree. Well, I watched Paula Deen on,
yeah.
and this you reminded me of this. She was on the Ellen DeGeneres show, and she was doing her version of bread pudding.
Right.
And it started with Krispy Kreme donuts.
Oh Lord!
Isn't that disgusting?
Paula does some strange things.
Okay. Well, we hope she's not listening to the program. But what was there a particular inspiration that had you turn around and wake up one morning and say, I have to write a cookbook about bacon?
There were two reasons, Peter, I'd say. There are two reasons. The first reason is because As maybe you know, I've done a lot of traveling in my life. I'm obsessed with bacon, have been since I was a child, and therefore every place I travel, South America, France, the Germanic countries, Italy, and so forth, if I see the word bacon, I order the dish. And it dawned on me, I said, you know, in America, when you hear the word bacon, you think about bacon with your eggs in the morning, you think about a BLT, you think about maybe a Cobb salad, or you think about some baked beans and that bacon in or on top of them. And I said, there is a whole international world of bacon out there that Americans don't know about. So I wanted to give this a fully international scope and introduce Americans, you know, to some of the most glorious bacon dishes around the world. Number two.
Now, I might point out that you actually, in your book, have a whole section where you go through all of these different sources of bacon, define them, so that anybody can use this as a reference book.
Right, and that is part of my number two here, and that is that for the first time in about 80 years, we in this country are now producing, there are artisanal small producers out there producing some of the most glorious bacon in the world, and they're all over America, and that bacon is finding its way finally into even our supermarkets.
Now, I agree with you completely. We just found Vermont Smoke and Cure, and we had some of their bacon. In fact, we still have a chunk of their slab bacon left. And it's really a wonderful product. I noticed that you have them in your book.
It is a wonderful product. And I'm not denigrating supermarket bacon completely. Some of it is lousy. But even some of the commercial bacon you're finding in the market, if you know how to shop for it, you know, is a fairly good product. But once you've tried an artisanal bacon, or a good imported bacon, and once you fry that up and see the milky ooze that comes out of bad commercial bacon, and once it shrivels up to nothing, then you realize why this because we had it around 80 years ago before it lost its popularity and the producers died out and so forth, and the new ones came in, let's say, in the past 10 years, then you know what a great bacon, a superior bacon is all about, a premium bacon is all about. I had two slices this morning.
Now
and every time I cut into it, as long as you don't overcook it, Peter.
Mm-hmm.
And this morning I was so aware of how delicious that was with my egg yolk.
There you go. Now, bacon with desserts. Bacon in desserts is
that's touchy.
That's a tough one, but you cross that bridge too.
That's very touchy, and that was a learning experience for me. Even though I'd had German bacon cookies, I was in Durham, North Carolina, at a place called Magnolia Grill.
We know them, yeah.
You know that, Ben Barker?
Yeah, we do.
And they, for dessert, I mean, I noticed they had chocolate bacon truffles, and I said, no way am I going to like this. And they brought them to the table, the most delicious things I've put in my mouth. I got the recipe.
Well, this is a James Beard award-winning pastry chef.
That's his wife.
Yeah, I know. I mean, she's right up there on top of the list of best
really
pastry chefs in the country.
Doing. And I tested those things, and I said, these are damn good. And then I began experimenting, and I've got, for example, a dish in there in which I take figs and wrap them in bacon and do them in a port wine sauce. And that is pretty good eating. But you've got to be careful. I mean, the concept of a good salty bacon playing against the sweetness, you know, of a sweet fruit or sugar or whatever is, it's viable. But there are a couple of commercial products now on the market because bacon is so popular. There is a bacon chocolate in a package that I think is ghastly.
Bacon chocolate?
I just think it is ghastly.
We just interviewed who makes blue cheese truffles.
Yeah, they're very good.
That's sickening.
But no, they're really.
See, Peter loved them.
They're very good. But the guy's chocolate shop is right next to the Rogue Creamery in Southern Oregon.
Oh my lord!
So he's sort of cheating. He's using some of the world's best blue cheese.
Who knows? I mean, I haven't tasted those. Maybe they're good. But that's the kind of in the South. That's the kind of line we don't cross. You know, usually.
And we've been ordering things from a place called Broadbent's. Do you know that place?
I've heard of Broadbent.
Yeah, but they have these hams, country hams, they auction off at the state fair.
Yeah.
For like six figures. It's a charity thing.
Yeah. They sell a very good bacon, by the way. I mean, if you want to check them out, it's broadbenthams.com. I mean, we think their product is really very...
Where are they located?
They're somewhere in eastern Kentucky, somewhere near Paducah, Kentucky.
You know, I do know. I know that name, and that really is ringing a bell with me. Maybe it's the country hams, because I'm so sensitive about country hams. You know, that is a subject we Southerners, you know, just could harp on 24 hours a day.
Yeah, but unfortunately, that's a subject for another program. Listeners, James Velas is a positive... he's learned dozens of cookbooks. But the Bacon Cookbook is the latest one. If you're fascinated by bacon.
I like your biography. Is that still in print?
The memoirs.
Yeah, the memoirs.
Between Bites. Oh, yes. Very much.
I love that. Yeah.
Thank you.
And then the other one we've been talking about is The Glory of Southern Cooking. You can order them through the bookshelf section, OTM bookshelf, on www.onthemenuradio.com. James, thank you so much for sharing part of your day with us.
Thank you, Peter. It's been a pleasure.
Okay. And these are good recipes.
Thank you so much, and eat plenty of bacon.
Let's hear it. The first thing you said to me before we got on the air, you said, do you have an English accent? I said, yes. And he said, which country in the world produces the best bacon? And I said, I think it's probably England, and you agreed with me.
Well, that's the main question I've been getting from everybody, and I have to bite my lip. And I say, okay, I'm always trying to be honest. And I said, my favorite bacon in the world is English bacon, and it is.
Okay.
You know why? You've got that wonderful little eye of lean from the loin, but you've still got from the ribs and the belly, you know, that little tail of fat.
Oh, yes, because you buy a piece all the way across.
Right. And, Peter, that bacon is available in certain supermarkets right now, and there is a source in my book down in Virginia where you can order that on the Internet.
It's called Longback.
Longback.
But anyway, we should let you get about your day, and we should do the same thing.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, James.
It's been great talking with you.
Yeah, you too.
Bye-bye.
Now it's time to take a break, but please come back and join us again on the other side.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back to the final segment of On the Menu Radio for this week.
When a book arrives called A Passion for Baking, you know you must be in for something special. And I've been talking for several weeks with Marcy Goldman, trying to arrange for her schedule and mine to match so that it was possible for us to talk about this really excellent and tremendously thorough book about what for Marcy has been practically a lifetime. Am I correct, Marcy?
Pretty well. I'm young, but it is still a replete book.
So when did you start baking?
I started baking around 7 years old or so, and I always saw the kitchen as sort of like an artist's gallery, and the ingredients were like paint palettes, and my mother gave me a free hand. And I just saw baking as kind of magical. I love cooking. I think I'm a really good cook. But baking to me was like just so exciting and quite a draw.
Now, have you been a professional pastry chef, or have you just been a teacher and a baker?
I have been all of those things. I was self-trained in the beginning, then in my early mid-20s or so, went to hotel school, the Quebec Hotel School here in Montreal, and trained for about 4 years to become a graduate pastry chef and what they call chef boulanger or chef baker and pastry chef. So that means I know yeast and breads as well as I do decorated cakes and whatnot. And I was always a writer, so I combined both being a pastry chef and a writer into food writing and freelancing for Washington Post and Bon Appetit, and that's how I started, and then segued into cookbooks, and I certainly do indeed teach baking to people.
Now, the material I got in the background of, you said Marcy maintains baking is more than a craft. Tell me what you mean by that.
I think it's a calling. I think it's in certain people's DNA or their destiny, but it is the most aesthetic thing. I mean, you're making food, which is nourishing and nurturing. You're making things that are beautiful, which is about aesthetics. You certainly are, in some cases, crafting, whether it's, you know, decorated cakes or not, or forming, which is like scones. And I think sometimes people dismiss it as either one end of the spectrum or another. It's either a fancy cheesecake or something that's very showcasey, or it's homespun muffins or cookies. But it's such a broad spectrum of possibilities that start with flowers. So it's almost everything.
Now, don't you worry a little bit? Here's a really nasty question. Don't you worry a little bit about the fact that desserts also happen to be rather rich in calories, and especially with our calorie-filled bodies these days? How do you respond to that?
It's not a nasty question. It's one I get all the time, and I always say, don't blame the baker. No, I mean, there's so many things you could eat and make from the baker's shop that are not all high calorie. In my book, I have a grainy chapter, the kind of wholesome things. A small piece of something decadent is not that many calories. A small truffle is still, you know, that, and also what it releases in sheer pleasure and endorphins and serotonin that might in fact inspire you to go, you know, for a long walk or the treadmill. But, you know, you have your whole day to eat well, and I think people focus too much on dessert as being sort of like the nemesis of your diet. I think it's about broad spectrum and mindful eating overall, and then you could fit it in.
So dessert really isn't sin. Dessert is pleasure. It's just that, like everything else, you have to have your pleasure in the right kind of quantity.
I think so. And remember, scones and breads and muffins and quick breads, these are very modest and kind of lower in sugar and fat. So cheesecake for sure is a big, you know, dessert and kind of, you know, you'll have to balance the rest of your day or your week. But something like a small scone, and you can make things smaller. You don't have to make, you know, a 4-ounce scone. You can make a 2-ounce scone and still be very satisfied.
Yeah, I was talking to somebody the other day who makes these absolutely delicious and very large and very expensive cookies in Vermont. And I said, what I did with them when I got them is I ate only about a sixth of one at a sitting, just because otherwise it would have been way too much. And she said, well, that's the way we do it too. We keep them in the freezer and we nibble.
Yeah, I think it's funny. People would rather nibble their way to 1,000 calories than legitimately sit down and have a 200-calorie slice of something and be engaged in what they're eating and aware that they're eating. I think we think nibbles, like the calories at Costco sample booths, don't count somehow. But they do. But a little bit is all you need sometimes.
Now, this book, Passion for Baking, is much more than just a cookbook, isn't it?
I think it really is an invitation to be present in your own kitchen and with joy, and to, you know, to do things that engage people at the table and thrill them, and it's very, very welcoming. And I like to think it's a teaching book as well.
Oh, I'm sure it is. I called it a primer, or a primer, as some people in the United States call it, because it really goes through making sure that you're ready, making sure you have all the right equipment, you have all the right ingredients, you know how to work with them.
I think it's so important. You know, you and I were speaking a little bit off air about this book offering advice and tools and what you need and what my favorite tricks are, which are very important. And I think a baking book, unlike a cookbook, you really have to gear people up with a little bit more advice and expertise to make sure that they're going to have success. And do it in a friendly way, but certainly give them all the basics they need, because you don't know at what point of their baking life they're picking up that book, so you want to make sure that they're equipped.
Now, we talked to one pastry chef who was an exceptional pastry chef, and we said, what is it about being a pastry chef that's different? And she said, well, one of the things that's very clear is you must measure. The ingredients have to be really accurate. Otherwise, it's just not going to turn out the way it's supposed to. Now, off air, I mentioned that to you, and you said, well, that's true to an extent, but...
Yeah, I agree. It's true to an extent, but because there isn't a very exact inherent balance in a baking recipe, you know, there's so much fat, there's so much leavener, so much body and structure, and you have to respect that, and you have to hope the recipe that you're using starts that with that innate equation. But beyond that, there is a certain spectrum of error, I mean, that you can do. I mean, you want to have good baking technique, and I think I discussed that in the book, but give a little bit more, a touch more vanilla or an ounce more butter or a little bit more cream cheese in a cheesecake. This is not going to be the deal breaker in a successful cake or not a successful cake. And I think when you talk about exactitude or pastry chefs talk about perfection, this is that phrase, I think, sends lay people or would-be bakers, you know, off in the other direction and buying frozen Pillsbury chocolate chip dough, which is, with all due respect to Pillsbury, by the way. But I think you want to use sound baking technique and be respectful, but get rid of that notion of perfection. Baking is a little bit more forgiving than we think.
Now, you talk about sweet butter as being an absolutely vital ingredient in baking.
Yes, that is a non-negotiable.
Except for some things you need other fats too, I guess.
I don't often use shortening in my baking recipes. On occasion, I will if I want a very neutral flavor, perhaps in a donut, sometimes a little bit of shortening or certain lightness in a pie dough. But overall, I don't think anything replaces the flavor of sweet butter or unsalted butter. And certainly products like margarine often are salted and they're whipped and there's a lot of chemicals. And they don't taste the right way and they won't perform the right way. And overall, you're better off with a little bit of healthy butter. But many of the recipes in the book as well would call for canola oil or olive oil. Not all of the recipes, but certainly there are some to choose from and if that's something that you're worried about.
Now, you mentioned vanilla as an ingredient. We had Patricia Rain, who calls herself the Vanilla Queen, on. Do you know Patricia?
Yes, and I've guessed it on her site. She's a love.
So you love vanilla too, huh?
If I could marry vanilla, I would marry vanilla.
So there's room for vanilla in almost anything, huh?
There really is. I mean, I think we use it a little indiscriminately. I was once talking to a French chef colleague, and he said, you Americans, I guess by broad stroke, he meant you Canadians as well, which I am. He said, you make orange cake, you toss in vanilla. You make a chocolate cake, you still toss in vanilla. Leave it alone. I think there are many things that would really sing without it, but most things are good with a little bit of vanilla. It melds the flavors together, and I think we're also habituated to that flavor in a pound cake. Sometimes you can go without. A shortbread, of course, doesn't need vanilla. You want to just taste that butter-sugar amalgamation.
Now, take us a little bit through the range of baked goods that are covered by the book, because there are chapters on all kinds of different aspects of baking.
Yeah, well, I think when you want to bake, you're really thinking in terms of something specific. We think in terms of occasion. We bake, in which case you're going to think cakes or cupcakes, I think. But generally, when people want to bake, they're thinking, I want a square, or I want a scone, or I want biscotti. So I divided up the book on chapters that way. There was a biscotti chapter, scones, just squares, just cookies, just cakes, just cheesecakes. And then what I did is I added the occasions. There's occasions for bread, and that's a beautiful and separate chapter on breads, and one on pizza, one on grainy things, which we discussed, which is healthy. And then what I think is a really, really serviceable chapter, a holiday baking chapter, which gives you one or two definitive recipes of major holidays. So it's like the best Christmas cake you'll ever get, the best hot cross buns you'll ever have. But conveniently, either you're thinking occasion or you're thinking type of baking, it's neatly put out. And there's an overview in the beginning of every chapter saying, if you're making muffins, this is all the baker's secret stuff you need to know. Or turn to cheesecake, and again, you're going to find an overview of that type of baking.
So the intention was that it would be really sort of a one-stop for everything you really need to know.
I guess selfishly, I was thinking, if I was someone buying the book, I'm selling a cookbook, I don't want anyone to open that book and think, this is missing, or where's that? I think, there's a quick and easy chapter. Some people are going to want things what's called Baker in a Hurry. But I think my thought was being generous as a baking friend to a baking reader. And the second part was, there isn't anything missing that you would have to go outside that book. I mean, there's certainly other books and other different styles of recipes. But if you want one-stop, serves-all type of baking book, this is going to be it.
Well, that's great. Now, how about picking just a few highlights, things that are in the book that you think are just part of the top part of the passion?
It's as I say, it's really hard to choose, but I think as we're approaching, the holiday season, I'd have to think there's the Rougemont apple cake, which is sort of like a beautiful mile-high apple tart, which is easy, show-stopping, reputation-building. There's a white chocolate pecan pie, which I love. And then, things like a toffee banana cream pie, which is like the most quintessential diner-style pie, but with, all the stops pulled out. There's also what I think is, people don't think of savory things in baking, but quite a few savory things. The food court pizza, which I think is wonderful. And this chunky cheese dough, which you could make a chunky cheese bread, rather, either right from scratch, and the recipe is there, or if you're in a hurry, you pick up some frozen bread dough, you marry it up with chunks of, sharp cheddar cheese and garlic, hack all those things together, throw in a loaf pan, let it rise, bake, and you have this incredible snacky type of pull-apart cheesy garlicky bread that is just so wonderful.
Now, you also just sent me a picture while we were talking of a cheesecake with things piled on top.
That is pumpkin eruption cheesecake, and that's at my website, betterbaking.com, and that will probably be in a passion for baking number two. And it's a cheesecake stuffed with chunks of vanilla fudge and gingerbread and swirls of caramel through it.
And it's called an eruption. What a wonderful word that is. It rolls off the tongue. It feels like I should be able to go down and get a piece out of my refrigerator right now to satisfy my craving.
Yes. Well, don't you think baking has to be a little bit more showy? I mean, there's all these wonderful Food Network shows, but they're mostly about cooking. And I think baking, to really engage people, you got to really, sell it and bring... I mean, there is natural theatrics to beautiful baking, and I think we have to express that in our recipe titles and how they're described. I think these are, important things in a book.
Well, I absolutely totally agree with you. I think that people try to do too many things to make the plates on regular dishes look special.
Yeah.
But there's something about dessert and the spun sugar and the other kinds of pieces of things that you can use in dessert making that can make a thing of beauty. And when the eye is excited like that, the stomach is excited at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. I mean, it begins with the eyes and that anticipation. And that visual thing means whoever created it also spent some time and care. And I think that's a certain food energy that transmits.
Well, the book is called A Passion for Baking. It's obtainable through the OTM bookshelf on the menu website, as well as, of course, all major booksellers. There's A Passion for Baking 2 coming somewhere down the road. Marcy already gave you a hint about that.
Yes, and A Passion for Cooking, because bakers do know how to cook.
There we go. And the website that will put you in touch with Marcy Goldman at all times is?
BetterBaking.com.
There we go. Marcy, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today.
Oh, my
and
pleasure.
Keep on baking, huh?
I will, and I won't count calories.
There we go. Well,
okay.
Thank you so much for joining us, and I guess think pumpkin pie and Christmas pudding and all those kinds of things, and you'll be on the right track.
Well, that wraps things up for another exciting On the Menu program. We hope that you enjoyed it, and you'll join us again, same time, same place, next week.